I have no trouble understanding what they're complaining about. Now, let me tell you what they're talking about. They're complaining about the fact that Wall Street wrecked the economy 3 years ago, and nobody's held responsible for that. Not a single person has been indicted or convicted for destroying 20% of our national net worth accumulated over the course of two centuries.
Welcome to the Karamcast, episode 22. It is December 17th, 2011, and I am here in beautiful Constant Change Chemical Light Factory Studios in Los Angeles. I've got my special guests and co-hosts, Truffle Jones.
Hi, everybody.
And, of course, the ever lovely Amy Lynn Chadwick.
Holla.
This is going to be an episode where we try to remember what the hell just happened in 2011. I think the last one was in June. The last thing we were talking about was Egypt uprisings, the now called Arab Spring. There was the tsunamis, there was internet privacy, and we were talking about Friendster being bought out by Facebook. Do you want to give us any updates on that, Truffle?
Truffs.
You know, I can't remember exactly when MySpace got purchased. I think it was maybe after our last session of discussion. But I want to just say I think it's hilarious for everybody who poo-pooed on Friendster. Facebook paid $40 million for Friendster's patents. MySpace, if you recall, bought by Che Timberlake and his team, was purchased for a measly $35 million. So the ousted, left upon initial social network actually worth more than the one that trumped it at the end of the day.
Hoo-ha.
Friendster will not come back. It will not take over Facebook.
It will not come back because all of their patents have been purchased by Facebook.
Right. And so where is Facebook in December of 2011? Truffle, I don't even think you've got an account on Facebook.
I'm completely not on the grid. I'm not on Facebook at all.
Just from a consumer point of view, a lot of timelining and games. There's a lot of asking if you can give me a cow so I can upgrade my farm. Not much has changed.
So just to tie up on Facebook, one interesting thing that didn't happen this year was there was no IPO. And that was the most often discussed thing at the early part of the year. One thing that came first was the IPO for RenRen, which was touted as China's version of Facebook. And it actually debuted at a much higher price than it is at now, which isn't uncommon. But that the way that it went up and came down was so rapid, everybody, I think, got scared a little bit. And with the economy being the way it is, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in 2012, which is a election year, which always has a strange effect on the economy, and to see whether or not Facebook is going to step forward and try and become that $500 billion company that we've been hearing about.
Speaking of China, I was looking at some of the best political photos of the week just last night, and one of the photos was this massive framework for the Enchanted Palace or whatever it's called from Disney World that was sitting rusting in the middle of a field in China where all these farmers had been evicted and moved out so that they could build this enchanted, it was called Wonderland, and it was supposed to be China's Disney World. Their whole bubble sort of popped, and now it's just sitting there rusting, and the farmers have actually moved back in, and they're creating their crops around this abandoned Disney World framework.
Awesome.
But, beautiful. You know, we're seeing the sort of pendulum swing away again from China's explosive growth that it was experiencing, except that now they're talking about how China will take advantage of opportunities with the EU's difficulties. It's kind of been amazing to me how in 2011, which seemed to start out generally okay. I mean, there are some people who said it was a terrible year and whatever. I thought the beginning of 2011 was full of ideas, full of excitement, innovation. There was things happening. We were digging our way out of the rut.
It was a lot better than 2010.
2010 was brutal,
it
for
sucked.
Sure. But 2011, a lot of amazing things happened, part of which we'll try to recall on this podcast episode. But in the second half, all of a sudden, it was as if on schedule, everything that had been predicted about the future started to manifest in full form, as if it was out of a scripted scenario. And we saw Occupy Wall Street, which was a social media driven presence that just showed up on the, you know, on Wall Street, become a global movement that created so much pressure that Time Magazine is going to name the protester the person of the year. And the cover is an illustration or a silkscreen by Shepard Fairey, who is an LA-based street artist. And it's of a photograph of a girl that was here in the Los Angeles OWS protests. But there were rubber bullets being fired, there was tear gas, there was mace being sprayed into students' faces.
Kids being dragged across the street.
Amazingly, nobody was actually killed, and there wasn't any real violence on the part of the protesters ever.
No.
But now we're in this very strange moment where this bill has been moved through Senate twice already, called the NDAA, that is going to transfer power from the FBI to the military to deal with citizens that may be associated with terrorism. And the definition is vague enough that the word associated with Al-Qaeda or anything like it, the only proviso that it includes is that American citizens are not mandatorily detained, but that doesn't mean that they can't be. And so as this happens, and Obama at first was going to veto this, and now the White House is retracting the statement that he made, or backpedaling, and saying that he will actually sign this through after some minor modifications were made, that means that Obama will effectively sign in a law that allows the U.S. to become a police state. I'm not going to express any opinion on this at the moment, but I simply want to say that it was amazing to watch gas-masked people running down the streets, fighting with their own police forces, and American citizens fighting among themselves in this almost Civil War-style explosion that the rest of the world was both sort of cheering and watching carefully, and they called it the Arab Spring and the American Fall. So quite a transformation. And I want to point out how much this felt like that night in Los Angeles when we were all sitting around and sort of noticed that it was a bit breezy outside. There'd been no news reports. There'd been no real warnings on television. And then all of a sudden, as you said, Truffle, there was these 90 mile per hour winds. And I saw the palm trees outside our studio bending at 45 degree angles until one of them exploded from the base and crashed onto the street and dragged all the power poles with it. And all of a sudden we found ourselves in a position of there's no power, there's no internet, there's no cable.
Luckily I charged my phone before that happened.
Smart.
So smart.
The thing is, it wasn't just about, you know, not having those connections, but about how quickly things can transform. And even if you have a supply kit.
It's so fast. And it wasn't even that the electricity went out. It was that the internet and the cable went out. And that's where not a lot of people, I think, now have landlines.
Let alone hand-powered radios. Or as you pointed out, Truffle, the fact that all they have to do is press a button and shut down all the cellular networks because there's going to invariably be a crush of calls whenever such a thing happens.
Oh, hell's no.
And so it's not about whether you're near a tower or whether that tower is up. It's about the fact that there's just a kill switch and it'll just shut off
Which
your communication.
They've used here in LA before. We had a pretty good shake up a couple of years ago. I think it was maybe just like a 4.1 or 4.8 or something like that. And it was known, it was not some kind of underground thing. They basically said they had to kill all of the calls that were active and clear all the lines for people who needed assistance at the time, like elderly people who were afraid or, were trying to get through to the various EMT teams and so forth. So yeah, it's a twofold thing. It's one, that we're always going to be at the whim of Mother Nature, whatever she decides to do, when she decides to do it. But also, two, the man does have the power to do that. He giveth and he taketh away. And we know we have a very unstable power grid in this country anyway, on top of everything else, unless you live in Texas. So we're really, really relying on it. And what's going to be the next thing? We saw a lot of global disasters in 2011, It's been a few years since we had a big one here in the U.S., but it could happen any day, especially here in Los Angeles.
The big ones
we had
in
droughts
the US,
this year. We had flooding this year. Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not belittling any of that.
No,
I'm just saying,
I didn't think you were.
To the amount of, like you said, the kind of global mobilization of paying attention to the fact that we can't take care of. Here's something that Karam and I were talking about a little bit earlier. We live in a time where our governments and institutions react better and fulfill better the needs of banks and other institutions than they do the people who live in their very own country.
Of course.
That says a lot.
Yeah. Have you looked at the neighborhoods affected by Katrina lately?
Actually, yes. Funny you should ask.
Yeah.
Yes,
tell me
I
about
have.
It.
You know, it's really interesting to go back down and see what's changed. First of all, if you spend any time at all in the Ninth Ward before Katrina, what was there in the lower part, what was there is completely gone. And when I say completely gone, a lot of what you saw in the media afterward, a lot of the rubble and destroyed buildings and so forth, have just whole hog been moved. Further up, you still see a lot of those, but right down at the bottom, those are gone. And what's happened, which is really cool, is Brad Pitt's Pink Houses program is in full effect. So you go down there now, there's still a lot of empty land, but you have these really aesthetically challenging and architecturally cutting edge houses that have been constructed for these lower income families.
Are they pink?
Well, some of them are pink, but no, not in general. They're not all pink.
I wonder why he calls it Pink Houses.
But the whole neighborhood is crush of, you know, all these famous or well-known architects who put together these programs, basically, or these designs just for this program, and you have these lower income families living in them, and it's just the strangest thing to see. But it's also very inspiring because it does show that, you know, when people get together and put their efforts into the right things, that a lot can be accomplished. And a lot of people who are displaced are back in their neighborhood again. And
people want to give back.
Yeah, but I don't have any concern about my fellow citizens. What I'm saying is, what did the government do in that initiative?
Well, isn't that interesting? It took a celebrity to actually mobilize everybody and to get these architects and architectural firms to contribute in the way that they did. It wasn't the United States government that got that particular thing
done. I think
done.
A lot of celebrities, like, I know for me, like, the reason why I want to do anything that I want to do with my career is because I want to be able to do that.
Well, I'm just saying, isn't that sort of part of what the government's around for, is to help kind of build these programs and help out where help is needed and to make sure that things are organized properly and coordinated? And
I always,
you know,
just assume
it's so weird. I heard this fairy tale once in civics class, something about by the people, for the people, but I don't think that's 2011.
Well, there's the by the people, anymore. For
that
the people, people,
sense.
And then there's this thing called the government that just seems to get in the way of all of that.
Exactly.
And siphon out their cash.
I think policing. The government's there to police. It's there to dictate, control, make sure that, you know, no one's out of line. Any kind of, like, work that has to be done by the people, for the people, comes from the people.
Seems to be that way these days. It's a little treacherous. It was interesting to look now, also in this year, at how a lot of studies were being done on what happened in the aftermath of Katrina, because people were saying this is the sort of situations that will arise in more and more places around the world. You know, people will develop pack mentalities. There's going to be rioting and looting, but it's not malicious. It's because when you're in survival mode, you have to do what you have to do to survive. It becomes us or them kind of mentality.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because that kind of leads into one of the things we wanted to talk about tonight, which is television, the year we had in television. And one of the programs that you and I have been watching here and there is The Colony, a reality-based TV show that supposes there is some kind of natural disaster or war-based disaster, technological disaster, and it puts people together in a group who literally need to figure out, okay, how do we create power? What do we do for food? How do we scavenge? How do we build? How do we filter water? Things that those of us sitting in this room probably don't actually think about enough or at all on a regular basis.
Well, those of us sitting in this room think about it a little bit too much. In fact, I often feel like the crazy one because I'll say to my friends, okay, we need to all get together and talk about what we're going to do in the event of this and that. They're like, bro, what's up? Chill out. Interestingly, the first season of The Colony takes place in downtown Los Angeles. They put a group of people who happen to be building contractors, handymen, right, rocket scientists, computer engineer there. And even then, they have to go around the clock and give up every last ounce of their energy to pull it off, to create renewable energy, to create reliable water, filtered water, find food stocks, create heat, light, even bathing, the slightest forms of entertainment so that they don't just kill each other and eat each other.
And let's not forget, they're also... There are gangs roving the streets while they're trying to do this. Right. There are people who are trying to assault the warehouse that they're holed up in. And it's, you know, it's all drama, but it really does give you some perspective into, okay, when something happens, be it an earthquake, which we can expect here, or be it some kind of nuclear event or whatever, it gives you some kind of perspective into what might it actually be like. And we're not rocket scientists or contractors or handymen or whatever, so it's kind of like you watch it, and if you don't take anything else away from watching that program, you can at least realize this. Those people are really smart, and they're having a hard time figuring out basically stuff that they do on a daily basis anyway.
How to start from scratch.
Yeah, what are the rest of us going to do? Yeah.
You need a lot of water every single day. What are you going to do when your faucets turn off?
Exactly.
The fact that you have... Basically, a human can live 48 hours without liquid before they're dead. You get about 2 weeks for food, but you get about 2 days for water. When your faucets aren't running and you can't call anybody and you can't go on the highways because they're going to be completely crammed and then gasoline's going to run out, so the cars are not going to move anymore. As we saw in Katrina, there was literally just abandoned cars for miles,
right,
on the freeways, so you can't escape that way. What's your plan? That's the question. And we're not sitting here being alarmists. This is actually a year where these things became reality. And, you know, I've been a fan of the movie Blade Runner since I was in my single digits. I've always thought about these things, Mad Max, all those kinds of movies. I always kind of thought about it for one reason or another. And it was as if the movies just started to come to life right now. And don't think this is going to slow down. This was not an anomaly.
No, this is a year for momentum building.
Also, 2012 is approaching upon us, and that stuff is kind of coming to the surface a lot more because people are starting to freak out about the whole 2012 thing.
I think we've covered at length. It's a bunch of
hooey.
But it is funny how these things... Now, we were doing an interview with this brilliant Italian via New York to LA artist named Nicola Verlato. He's one of the coolest, smartest, and most prolific contemporary LA post-pop surrealists.
He's awesome.
And he was talking about the difference between the Western view on art versus the Asian perspective. And in the West, we have this kind of scatological view of time. Everything moves in a linearity, meaning it's moving towards an ending. That means that you're always expecting there to be this end, this apocalyptic finish to everything. So we don't like to revisit things in the past because we have to always be moving forward, developing something, innovating, progressing. And therefore, he said, you know, if he was to go back to Europe, to Italy, for example, where he's painting these Caravaggio-esque depictions of Mexican wrestlers, they would say, well, this art isn't valid because all you're doing is revisiting the corpses of the past in art. But he says one of the important things in the LA art scene right now is that there's actually a strong Asian influence, and the Asian culture looks at things in a cyclical fashion. In fact, it's important to go back and revisit and refine and renew things that have occurred in the past because they're always going to come around. It's a cyclical thing. So in the West, we have this idea that if we say in 2012, the Mayan calendar says the time is going to end, what we do is instead of slowing it down, pulling the brake and figuring out solutions to bypass it or to go around it, we actually hit the accelerator and grind towards this apocalypse that we've been waiting for, almost as if just to prove that it's true. It's because that's how our mind and our logic is defined for us in the West. So that example of Easter Island that I once pointed out, you know, where they had they had these giant heads that they were building to their ancestors to get better crops. Those giant heads that they had, those stone totems, required them to cut down their trees, their finite amount of trees, so that they could roll these heads out to the shorelines and in tribute to their ancestors. But there had to have been a point at which there was only 5 or 6 trees left. And instead of them saying, guys, maybe we should chill out on this idea and let the trees grow back, they actually said, we're going to go to war and figure out who gets the last 5 trees. And at some point, someone was holding that axe or that whatever stone tool and saying, this is the very last tree. My side of the island's going to get it, not yours. They chopped it down. The birds stopped coming. The seeds stopped planting, and they all just wiped themselves out. And they left this mysterious alien series of, you know, giant heads on this island. But that's kind of what we will do. We will see that the resources are running out, the opportunities are running out, communication is failing, and rather than slow down and rethink it, we will probably just dynamically push towards, well, what's going to happen? Let's see how bad it can get.
I hope I move before then.
To where?
Anywhere.
I think I sent you to an article someone wrote about why the best thing to do in a time like this, even if the U.S. becomes a overtly police state, is to stay put.
Well, stay put, but stay out of New York and L.A. and San Francisco and Chicago.
What do you say about moving down south or moving, like I read in that article, it's like move to Texas, but then whatever. So what if you move to Texas, like adjacent?
They were saying Texas because Texas can manage its own energy. It has its own resources for...
They all have guns.
For processing oil. They all have guns and whatever. Let me tell you something. Speaking of Louisiana and New Orleans and all that, I have since our last podcast gone to Shreveport where I shot Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D. And I spent 6 weeks there. The reason I'm pointing out that I was in this film was because when you're in a movie, you're not just a tourist. You're not just someone who is on your own schedule. You have to do what is required for the film to be made. And, you know, these horror films are usually made for a relatively small budget. So you're pushing a lot of hard hours. A lot of compromises get made in terms of comfort and even safety sometimes. And in this case, there was a unprecedented heat wave that had temperatures in the triple digits for over 35 days. And this was not only in Louisiana, but this was in Texas. This was all around that area. It was like 14 states were basically on watch for this heat wave. And I just thought, how are we going to survive this thing? I've never had so much water to drink in, and that's given that water was available. So I was drinking 14, 15, 16 bottles every couple of hours, mixing that in with Gatorade and, you know, cool compresses, ice, because that's what I had to do to stay conscious.
You must have been in the bathroom a lot.
Sort of, yeah. But I mean, after a while, your body's just like retaining it.
Yeah.
The thing is that the feeling that you have, doesn't matter how prepared you are psychologically, what happens is that you start to just get very, very sleepy. And falling asleep when you feel that way is the most dangerous thing you can do. And your mind starts to go. Your brain function starts to actually fall apart. And you start to convince yourself that it's probably best just to give up for right now. You don't get this choice of higher thinking of, oh, here's the better solution, or I've got to keep going, or whatever. You actually go through these biological processes that make you want to just quit. And so what we would do is we would retreat whenever possible to the 65 degree air conditioned inside of everything, which on its own at extended exposure makes you feel crazy. And I thought, wow, if the power grid went down in the midst of these heat waves, I don't know that Texas would be a place I'd want to exist.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I would always prefer to go up to Northern Canada. But, you know, I think that article was saying that Northern Canada wouldn't be protected from Korean invasion or blah, blah, blah. I mean, bottom line is enjoy what is going on outside your window right now, because this is as good as it's going to get for a long time. This is perfect. You've got birds outside still.
It's the same thing of, you know, there is no better than here. Every time you get there, you want to go somewhere else and, you know.
Crack.com had a little something they like to call 7 bizarre trends that predict an economic collapse. Some pretty interesting indicators, comedy aside. Number 7, check this one out, mosquito population surge.
Ew.
The reasons why, because when people are short on money, one thing they're going to do is they're going to knock off their pest control, the expense of that every month. Also, we have all these foreclosed homes sitting out there where rainwater is collecting stagnant in pools, and we have swimming pools that aren't being treated properly anymore, or empty swimming pools where water is collecting. Those are all places where mosquitoes breed and live.
Yeah, this just ties into my interest in the whole, you know, what's it going to be like post-apocalypse? Because that's expressly what's going to happen. You know, these are the things that you will not think will happen until you start to notice the signs. You know what I mean? You
Absolutely.
Have a lot of batteries and chewing gum ready, but you're not going to think about the fact that there's going to be a billion mosquitoes.
Yeah,
also.
Where's your mosquito repellent? Put your mosquito repellent in your survival kit today.
Please.
Number four, crime gets weird. So even though crime DUI numbers are down and crime in general is down, the crime that does exist gets weird. One of the biggest crimes on the rise right now, guys, dog napping. Dog napping for a couple of reasons. One is that you have a lot of fancy bred dogs out there that are worth a lot of money, people who are willing to pay $1,000 for a pet. You've heard probably heard the phrase the last couple of years, fur babies, for people who are not stable enough or not ready enough to have children of their own. So what they do is they buy these fancy pets and they spend thousands of dollars on toys and clothes and doctors. And
that's messed up.
So dog napping up for that reason. Also, check this one out. I kidnap a dog, I wait for the signs to go up, reward, I found your dog, pay me $500.
Actually, also, that sounds like a pretty good idea.
That's a good one, let's hit it.
Also, I think, can we add something to that one? What about just random shootings? Like just the other day, like down the street, some girl broke up with this guy and he just starts shooting people.
Well, yeah, not just dog nappings, but weird crime in general.
Yeah,
crime
weird
just
crime.
Gets strange.
Just random shootings.
Number one, men have more affairs, and actually it stands to reason that women do too, they say. But basically what happens is that when men get depressed and are emotionally distraught and they feel like the end is near, they get incredibly horny. And the idea is that it's some kind of survivalist instinct that kicks in, which is basically like, the end is nigh, I need to spread my seed everywhere possible to make sure my DNA replicates.
Gross.
And so, I don't know. Are affairs on the rise right now? I don't know. But if they are, it's one potential indicator that we're at economic collapse.
Well, I can even understand that from the point of view of just wanting to reach out, you know, have backup plans.
Well, I think
it's true. People want to connect out with other,
like
all opportunities in the sense that, you know, you don't want to put all of your eggs in one basket.
Right.
It makes sense.
Well, bad times
even for
makes
a woman
her strange
to say,
bedfellows.
You know, I can't, if I rely on this one dude to like tear down the walls and beat off marauders in the midst of trauma, you know, and he goes down, then what am I going to do? I got to have a crew.
Well, there's a quote here that says, according to Reuters, about 30% of, I read that wrong. 40% of couples reporting infidelity manage to stick out the marriage. Those people, actually about 30% of them, think that the unfaithfulness was only caused by temporary tension. Temporary tension, unemployment, you know, problems with their job, whatever.
I think it's great. It's a good list. I mean, I think part of the whole point about preparedness or our understanding, you know, difficult times is that the problems that you're going to face are not the problems that you're already familiar with. Talk about that film Life in a Day that you saw this year. That was a popular documentary.
So one night I went on YouTube and I noticed that they got this amazing new feature for movies. Free movies. And the first thing I saw was this documentary and it was Life in a Day. It was beautiful. Apparently everyone on that specific day was told via online, I don't know what website told them, they said, film your day. Film this day, 11:11 or whatever, whenever it was, and just start from the beginning of the day, like how you start out and till the end. And it was ladies in Africa who start off the day at midnight and they're like going out and then the sun rises and their babies are sleeping and they have to like fish and all this stuff. And then, you know, somebody in New York who wakes up at noon and they're trying to wake up their grumpy boyfriends. And then this guy who his wife is dead and he has to wake up his son every morning to pray and light incense for his mother, and then you see his day go by and the music and the visuals and just seeing all of these lives in one 24-hour span. It seems so simple, but it was captivating and completely intriguing and amazing.
So Life in a Day is a compilation of videos from all over the world in the same 24-hour period.
Yeah, I kind of drew that out.
What other great docs happened this year? I think the Cave of Forgotten Dreams that Werner Herzog made finally hit the theaters. And it's probably going to get nominated for an Oscar, so I'm just going to mention it now before it all happens.
That one's crazy.
Well, it was shot in 3D, but they actually basically had unprecedented access to the Chauvet Caves in France, where two mountain climbers found a cave entrance. They squeezed their way through it, and it just seemed like a lot of crystal and stalactites and so on were in there, a couple of bear skulls. And then they realized that those bear skulls didn't look like normal bear skulls. When they got to the back, they found these pristine paintings of animals, but really good ones. And they looked so fresh that they weren't sure exactly what area they were from. They brought some archaeologists back, and they noticed that the carbon that had developed over top and the calcium that had developed over top of these dated these paintings back 30,000 years, that these were in fact the earliest cave paintings that had ever been discovered.
Was that because something fell down and like blocked the cave?
That's right. There had been a fall in front of the cave that basically sealed it off and it preserved it perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But what's incredible about these paintings is that you'll actually see a horse head and then multiple horse heads behind it. And the assumption is that because of the flickering torchlight, those multiple drawings of the horse head would have been like the earliest cinema trope, that you would have actually seen that horse animated as it moved from one position to another.
Nice.
That the bison have eight legs, you know, in forward and back positions, so that again, in the torchlight, it would look as if they were running. So it's a pretty extraordinary film. He's the only person who's ever had camera access to it, and he only had an hour to shoot at all, because even the breath of too many visitors can create mold on the walls that can compromise this thing. So they've actually made a multi-billion point laser scanned model of the entire cave, of every single square inch of it, so that they can study it that way. What's cool about it is that Werner Herzog's film, A Gyre, Wrath of God, is also considered Time Magazine's number one film of all time. But Werner's like a kind of guy who just goes in and gets what has to be done. He's extremely courageous. And, you know, the cameras that they used are not necessarily the best. The footage isn't necessarily always stable or smooth. But he just goes in there and makes sure that this is documented properly as it is. So that was pretty exciting. It's those cave paintings, why they're so important. People might say, oh, big deal, you know, whatever. It's for museum stuff. Why it's important is because it identifies the fact that there were humans at one time walking through France when lions lived there.
30,000 years before Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
30,000. Think about it. I'll wait for you.
Well, those humans were separate from the Neanderthals in the fact that by putting paintings up on the walls that essentially animated what was going on outside the cave, they had the concept of a future, because to write something is to say someone else will read this. That was the distinction between them and their other peers that were not quite like sapiens. And probably one of the most impressive parts is that there's a hand print on a wall that's been outlined by the charcoal. And so someone's saying, this was made by a human. You know, here is my handprint. I mean, that's what's so significant. And in the same way that they did that, that's the relevance of Werner Herzog going in there with the camera and shooting it. He's not shooting it for himself. He's shooting something. He's capturing images that will be also passed on to a future generation. In a way, it's why we record this podcast. This is not for a present day audience. This is not happening live.
For our own.
This is happening for somebody in the future that will hear this moment and be like, oh, that's what the mindset was like then. That's what was the zeitgeist at that point.
Or at least ours.
And that's why I take an interest in a film like Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
No, it's pretty incredible to think about.
We also saw Martin Scorsese's George Harrison documentary, Living in the Material World.
Well, we saw half of it. We saw precisely half of it. The first half, which basically just kind of readdressed everything that we've known since day one about the Beatles and myth and lore, and was, quite frankly, I think we thought a little sterile and boring.
Was that the one that was on HBO or Showtime?
It was.
Yeah, it had a lot of publicity, but it was pretty flat for me, at least.
There's some great pictures we've never seen before, but otherwise...
I don't think George Harrison has ever gotten the proper tribute.
That's true, and I was hoping for that, because I think he was pretty enigmatic, and he definitely steered the Beatles in some very important key directions as far as spiritualism and just the esoteric nature of what they were involved in. And yeah, this documentary was built around the idea that the controller of the Harrison estate, which I believe is George's widow, basically approached Scorsese and said, listen, I've got this huge archive of stuff that literally has never been seen by the public. Will you make a film around it? So Scorsese did his best, and I guess some people really like it, but I don't know. There's just something about the pacing of it. Maybe it didn't need to be 4 hours long. Maybe it needed to be an hour-long special.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, writing in any form, whether it's film or, you know, a computer game or plain old writing, is editing. And if you can't edit, you can't have a good story. And it just was not that compelling. Even for people like us who love music, you know, I'm not the biggest Beatles fan, but I do have a great appreciation for George Harrison. I just found it to be, like you said, flat. And, you know, one thing that's interesting about George Harrison is his first solo record post-Beatles was All Things Must Pass, which was a triple album.
I loved.
So, yeah, amazing record, right?
Right?
Consider it's a triple record.
I listened to that over and over and over and over again. I loved it.
I just finished a course at UCLA about documentary storytelling, and it was really eye-opening. I took it there because I wanted to complete this doc I've been working on for a few years about the LA art scene. And I was running into problems because there's so many different roads and so many stories to tell, and it's like, you know, how do you bring this home? How do you make this compelling for 2 hours? And what they were teaching us is that documentaries are not news segments. They're not meant to be made on time. A news segment has to be timely. It has to happen when it happens. Documentaries are actually about timelessness. They make sense because they can compress a very long progression through time into a short amount, and you can see how things change. What's amazing about that was that a documentary filmmaker has to pick up on a subject before it became as relevant as it did, or before this terrible ending or amazing epiphany at the end happens. So you are operating on this faith as a documentary filmmaker. You're simply moving forward into a future that has not yet been written. And eventually you have to bring all that back around. And I guess what I learned was that documentaries really are entertainment. As much as they are about the real world, you have the moral dilemmas of, you know, you have to let people be represented by what they said and not change what their meaning was. But at the same time, you have to edit the crap out of it to make it interesting
watchable
for 2 hours and entertaining. So remember, when you watch documentaries, you are watching something that is probably in front of you because it was successful at being entertainment. The ones that weren't probably are not being seen by you because they're way too obscure. They probably didn't get distribution.
I think we should pour one out for the editors right now in the world because they have a hard job.
True that.
As I look at Man on Wire, that little card out there, see? I love Man on Wire.
Let's talk about the Muppet movie that came out just for a minute. Do you guys care? Don't care?
I saw it. I actually got the pleasure of seeing it at El Capitan, where it was filmed, I believe, right? And it was amazing. It was that good old-fashioned fun that we miss in movies these days. So
there's a lot of people who are cynical about the return of the Muppets.
F them. Sorry.
As Jason Segel, who is the guy that's pretty much solely championed bringing the Muppets back and slapping Disney on the wrist for letting that incredible property rot in their merchandising cellars, says
him
that when he was asked about, you know, how it was working as an actor and the creator of this film and everything else, he said that acting is the easy part. You know, if the character's happy, he makes a happy face. If the character's sad, he makes a sad face. That's his full acting technique. I thought, man, that's so right. What have I been doing, like, working on all the rest of it? I don't need to psychoanalyze myself and go to all of these, like, abusive acting classes where I'm stripped down to the bone. If he's happy, make a happy face. If he's sad, make a sad face. That's all you really need.
Let's all make a happy face.
Yay.
I guess what I'm getting at with all of this is, when you look at the narrative, the drama films in 2011, there was a lot of stuff that came out, but honestly, it was quite forgettable.
Well, that's where we got into a little bit earlier when we started talking about the colony, but 2011, not a great year for Hollywood in terms of Hollywood films and entertainment, big scale entertainment.
Weird.
But in the small screen, we're still, you know, people, writers in general, are referring to this being the golden age of television. We're seeing so many great television shows that people stay home and watch, you know, whether they're watching them on Netflix after the fact or they're watching them illegally on torrent sites
or
they're actually, yeah, DVR, they're actually paying for them, whatever. Shows like Breaking Bad, shows like The Walking Dead, which
Shameless.
Is... Shameless. Again, and what was the one you were talking about earlier?
Oh, All-American Horror Story.
People love that show.
Yeah.
Dexter's in, like, I don't know, season 5, 6, something like that now.
And even, like, the comedy.
Game of Thrones, they've adapted that very successfully at HBO, which to take that massive epic, it's a giant-scale epic based in, you know, a medieval world, and to condense it to the small screen and still tell the story without any kind of budget at all is pretty amazing storytelling for
television. What's interesting about that, though, is the fact that the advertising models for traditional television are worse than they've ever been. I mean, everybody's, you know, is programming their own schedules. They're watching things on Hulu. They're watching things off the torrents. So why is more money going into television programming as opposed to the controlled situation where you actually put asses into a movie theater seat, you sell $12 popcorn and $8 bottles of water.
Why is the
shift happening?
I'll tell you why. Because people don't want to leave their house. They'd rather watch quality programming at their own discretion.
But if that was the only case, then you could put crap on TV and people still would, you know, watch it.
No, not if it's not good.
Yeah, I think there's many. Here's a couple things. You know, one thing is we had the writer's strike a couple of years ago. I think it's a shame. We just poured one out for the editors. Let's pour one out for the writers. It's a shame that Hollywood doesn't care more for the writers, because what's happened is the year, give or take, that the writers weren't working means that less better scripts have come to fruition in the last couple of years that have followed. So
yeah,
we're watching last year, 2010, this year, next year in 2012. We're basically watching what
could
was exactly. We're seeing a small percentage of what the possible pool of quality scripts were out there to be made within a year or 2 years and put out.
Like, it's all been stifled and now it's finally getting its voice.
I think that's one reason. I think another reason is Amy's right. You know, for me to go to the theater and drop, I saw Hugo a couple weeks ago. It was on a date. So for me to go to the theater,
ooh,
I go for two reasons. I go on a date, or I go because it's some kind of large scale spectacle that needs to be witnessed on the big screen.
Yep.
I don't need to see a film like, you know, a rom-com like The Proposal on a giant screen. I simply don't, unless it's because, you know, I have my paramour with me and she really wants to see it. I think what's happened, to Amy's point, is there's less of an impetus to get up off your couch and go see that type of movie
for
at the theater
bucks
when you can watch it on your 42-inch flat screen in your living room.
Okay, so the bottom line in all this is that the golden age of television has not only continued, but it's actually increased and improved.
And there's,
upon what we were talking about even 3 years ago, we were saying was the golden era of television.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot more improved because of DVRs and Hulus and the, you know, HBO Go and the Netflix. And
to be fair, those other viewing platforms, ergo Hulu and all of that, are in fact finding ways now actually to monetize where they didn't have it before. I remember Hulu was just an aggregation site where anybody could watch whatever they wanted. But now Hulu is up for like a $1 billion sale, and the new Xbox update for their dashboard, which, you know, at first you're gonna go, oh God, here he goes about his Xbox. But let me tell you something, Apple got it wrong. Microsoft got it right when it comes to TV. The new update is completely voice controlled. It's totally hand gesture controlled. And they've unrolled what they call video apps and apps for everything. Everything is modular now. So in fact, I can download the Hulu app, the Netflix app, the Sci-Fi TV app, Epics films. And now they're gonna add to it HBO Go. They're gonna add TMZ, all of these things, so that I'm basically buying those programmers a la carte. I just pay my $8 a month for Hulu, and I can watch almost any current television show that's in the Hulu program. But the caveat is, for that $8 I'm spending, when I watch Hulu, there are still forced 30-second pre-roll ads at the beginning of everything.
And sometimes during Hulu, in the middle of, if it's a long show, they will stop and do like a 23-second commercial.
And unlike television, I can't fast forward it.
Well, for those operators, there's really only two revenue streams. One is the subscription model, and one is the forced advertising model. And in the case of Hulu and Netflix, sometimes you get both. But the reality is that, just as we saw with iTunes, what's happening with Hulu and Netflix and so forth is that the consumer has been given the ability to vote for what they want to see when they want to see it. And with that increased power, the people who provide the content are struggling for ways to make the money to continue to provide the content. So I'll tell you one thing I hate is when you buy a DVD or you buy a Blu-ray disc and you have forced trailers or forced commercials at the beginning of that disc. It's like, wait a second, I just paid 10 or 12 or 20 bucks to own this thing and put it into my library. Every time I fire it up, I got to watch that. Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
but I have a little sympathy for them, because if not for that, where are we going to get all these great shows like Walking Dead and Breaking Bad and The Wire and so forth?
Yeah, but what about 10 years down the line, when those forced commercials are irrelevant, and you still have to watch that crap?
Then you actually will go, look how cool like people's hairstyles were back then. I mean, it becomes a part of the value of it, right. I would think.
I guess eventually
the cultural imperative.
Okay, I just want to do a couple more little notes on tech stuff while we were sort of segueing out of TV land and Xbox 360s. But one thing I wanted to talk about was the fact that Kindle Fire came out in the meantime. Kindle Touch also came out. The Kindle Touch is actually the keyboardless version of the Kindle, but it's still the black and white e-ink thing. And the Kindle Fire, it's almost like a tablet, except it doesn't have all of the functionality of an iPad. In fact, the difference between the Kindle Fire and an iPad really now outlines why I was a champion of the Kindle for so long, when people said, but it's not, doesn't even have color, versus the iPad. The philosophy difference now between Apple and Amazon becomes increasingly evident. And I put my money on Bezos. Let's not talk yet about the fact, the elephant in the room here, that Mr. Steve Jobs has since deceased since our last podcast. And in all respect to him, what's amazing about the Kindle Fire is that it's $199 for this full-color, powerful, app-driven, Android-derived portable device. How can it be that that Kindle Fire is $199 and the iPad 2 is about $900? The difference is because Apple puts all of its interest in the hardware, in selling the hardware itself. They want to build you a powerful computer that you can carry around, that has tons of memory, and it's all contingent upon the reliability and the power of that hardware. Jeff Bezos of Amazon's philosophy is completely the opposite. He says the device is just a window to the cloud. He goes, the only point of the Kindle Fire is you can throw away your Kindle Fire. You can pour coffee on it. Just buy another one. And I've always argued this. I've always said, forget the price of the iPod. The iPod is irrelevant. What matters is the catalog that's behind it. I want access to that music. Make the device not be the barrier to entry. So with the Kindle Fire, you get one of those things, and all of a sudden you have access to Amazon's entire movie library. I don't mean in the iTunes philosophy where you have to buy each of those movies. I mean, you can freaking watch any movie on Amazon for the price of your Kindle Fire. The other argument that I continue to support the Kindle for is not just that it's connected to Amazon's library, but the fact that there's an ancillary market that has developed as the result of the relationship between a Kindle device and Amazon's cloud. And that is the independent Amazon publisher. There are now dozens, if not hundreds or thousands, of writers who are publishing books on subjects that they are experts in. They're not necessarily good writers. They could be a car mechanic. They might be somebody who knows how to build or you know, disarm a bomb, or how to build a survival kit, or how to change your spending habits. And their writing is not necessarily good, but you now have access to the minds of these experts that you may not have had before because of the gatekeepers that were the publishing world. And so now you can buy these books directly from your Kindle for 99 cents that are rated by the Amazon community. And that is what creates the filter and the quality control. That's available only via that process. You will never find those books in print. They will not have ISBN numbers that are not assigned to a digital edition of that book. So again, I maintain that Amazon is moving in the direction that will matter most in the future, whereas this iPad, this hardware-dependent technology, will eventually start to show its age, and well, I think soon.
You know, we talked a little bit about this before. I agree with absolutely everything you just said, except for there's a little bit of an apples and oranges thing going on there, because one of the things we were talking about was travel. And you can take your iPad and you can go overseas with it, and you can pop in a SIM card to whatever country you're in, and you can use it as a communication device based out of that particular country. You can't do that with a Kindle.
Nope.
So it depends on what you're doing with the device. If you're just looking at it apples to apples in terms of using it to run apps and look at media, yeah, it's kind of a hands down no win situation, because the iPad doesn't really make sense at its price point. But if you're doing it for other things, if you're using it for other things, then it makes a little more sense and the paradigm shifts a little bit.
I always thought the Kindle was meant to read books. And so I am completely fine with my Kindle, my original Kindle. And I was recently in the boonies, no sense of being able to get online. And I thought, I know my Kindle has free 3G. And my roommate at the time had a Kindle Fire. And hers had wireless or whatnot. She could not even turn it on. It wouldn't even turn on. But mine, being the original, turned on 3G wireless. And I somehow got to hack into Facebook.
I think because hers was, I think yours was 3G Wi-Fi and hers was just Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And you bring up an important point, you guys, in the sense that, yes, the one sort of caveat in my argument is that I'm assuming that the cloud will be there. The problem with the cloud, as amazing as the technology is, in fact, even Xbox now made it available to save your games to the cloud as opposed to your hard drive. Well, let me tell you, that was all pretty useless to me when the wind took the power grid around our neighborhood down.
Sure.
I couldn't access any saved games. I couldn't watch any movies. The only movies I could watch were my DVDs. So certainly the idea of this cloud-based world that we're moving into is strangely happening in parallel with a time in which the U.S. government is trying to block IPs that do questionable things as far as piracy is concerned, and are going to actually nerf the internet in a very dangerous way. It's a very interesting motion of one thing moving forward and relying upon something that the government is trying to mitigate.
Well, I'll tell you guys this. That's absolutely right about the cloud. It's only as useful as the devices you have and the access you're permitted to have to it. But, you know, my library is great because if I lose power and it gets really cold, I can just light my books on fire. Good luck with your Kindle or your iPad.
Yeah. Couple more small sort of entertainment tech stats.
Okay.
Modern Warfare 3 came out. It recently just hit $1 billion in sales, which it did quicker than Avatar did. So it is now officially the fastest piece of entertainment selling in entertainment history.
Really?
Yes, ma'am.
More so than Skyrim?
Skyrim was the number two seller, which was the ubiquitously discussed game from Bethesda. I'm not going to bore anybody who's not a gamer, but basically this is a giant open fantasy world where every single item that you look at can be interacted with. It's got almost photorealistic environments, especially on the PC. But the most important thing about Skyrim, which was the sequel to Oblivion and Elder Scrolls and all of this other stuff, is that they developed a AI quest system. It's called the Radiant Quest Engine. And what it does is it looks at everything you've done in the game so far, all of the decisions you've made, everything, the small ones and the big ones, and it starts to actually generate quests customized based on your decisions. So essentially, you have got an infinite number of quests to play. You'll never run out. There's a main storyline, but the rest of it is sort of made up by this engine.
So you
that sounds like my last girlfriend. She took a look at everything we had done up to date, to that point and then just generated a whole bunch of extra bullshit.
Oh, sir, I will not comment on that.
When's that podcast?
What was the album of the year, Truffle? I mean, we're going to be talking about this on Music Zeitgeist. I'm going to be compiling a list from 5 or 6 of our favorite contributors slash tastemakers. But it gets harder and harder every year because there's less and less of a filter. There's less and less of a sort of singular source that's pumping out those records.
Well, it's harder every year also because there are way more releases than we have the time, not only just to listen to, but the time to really invest in and find the nuances in what we're listening to. You listen to something once now, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah.
I don't know what the album of the year is. There were a lot of things that were just pretty spectacular. Again, unlike the film industry, the movie industry, the music industry has seemingly thrived. And of course, the foregone conclusions are, you know, the Watch the Throne album with Jay-Z and Kanye and Adele's 21 and so forth. But there's a lot of strange stuff that came out this year that was actually really good. One album that swept me off my feet this summer that I listened to over and over again, it's very much a summer record, was Washed Out's latest release. Absolutely loved listening to that. Love seeing those guys live.
Washed Out is, they've got about 3 or 4 records out?
They've got 1 full length and a couple EPs.
So okay.
This was the full length. Everything down to the cover art I thought was great. Took me completely off guard. Didn't really know anything about them. And anytime you get turned on to a record that kind of comes out of left field, it's always something that's a little bit magical. And that's what that record was for me this year.
Amy, favorite records?
Butch Walker and the Black Widows, The Spade.
Who's Butch Walker?
He's been a songwriter, performer, musician, I guess, for a long time, since the 80s. Had some hair bands back in the day. And then he went on to do solo albums and then produce like Avril Lavigne, Pink, and all those kind of people. Just not really getting the recognition, but he has his own band now and it's called The Black Widows. And it's great, like seeing them live. I saw them live in Santa Monica, like a very, very small venue. And it was just such that feeling that you want when you go to a show that's totally pumped up and you just, you're jazzed to hear the music. And when you get the record, you bring it home and you wanna listen to the whole album and read all the lyrics and listen to it over and over again. And I miss that with music. And so.
All right. For me, unquestionably, 2011 record of the year is PJ Harvey's Let England Shake. Mm. It's won too many awards to even count at this point, but the first time I heard it was the best thing because it was almost like the first time I heard Smells Like Teen Spirit. I had no idea who it was. I had no idea it was coming. I was driving my car through the streets of LA and on some college radio station, this freaky, jangly, voodoo Kate Bush meets Jane Sibbery thing starts playing. And I'm like, I don't know what this is, but this is off the chain. And it ends up being one of my favorite artists of the last 2 decades, PJ. So the fact that she could completely catch me off guard, make me feel excited, energized, charged up, rebellious, inspired, was just mind-boggling to me. On top of which, she essentially predicts in that album the English riots that happened. I mean, she's pretty much outlining why they did, why they would, what the concerns were, what it would look like. And that really is what defined the year. You know, to say Let England Shake is to say let the core of the establishment rock on its foundations because things are going to have to shift. And that's PJ. And she nailed it. She totally put a nail gun right through its temple.
Amen.
Amen. I like that one too.
Okay, well, a couple of deaths happened this week, and not that this is a news program, but I do have to point out that Christopher Hitchens, the very much beloved British writer who wrote for Slate, for Vanity Fair, and was very critical of Bush during his presidency about, you know, intelligent design and capital punishment. Hitchens considered himself an anti-theist, and he died this week of pneumonia after fighting esophageal cancer. Cesaria Evora, the famous barefooted.
Didn't know. Huge fan.
Yeah,
saw her live. Still, you know those things called CDs?
No.
5-inch discs of plastic with zeros and ones on them?
Right.
I have a bunch of those with her name on them.
Yeah, she passed away, I think, either today or yesterday.
Very sad news.
Etta James is terminally ill.
Terminally ill, saw that.
Leukemia.
And the worst one, not that there's a better or worse, but for me, the one that resounded most personally was the death of Russell Hoban, who was a generally unknown, at least by my contemporaries, or at least in North America, but he wrote at least 50 children's books. But most importantly, he wrote a book called Ridley Walker. And Ridley Walker was a book that he said on May 14th, 1974, which just happens to be the date and year of my birthday, he was hit by this sort of flash from the sky sort of force that told him he had to start writing this story. And it's written phonetically. You have to almost read it out loud to understand what the hell you're reading. It's a phonetic kind of English. And it seems to be happening in 14th century England, Punch and Judy puppets and, you know, almost like a Monty Python-esque thing, except that you realize eventually that the narrator of the book is someone who's about 15 years old and has picked up English through the scraps of old documents that he's found lying around the landscape. And that, in fact, this is happening in the future, and that it's after some sort of nuclear apocalypse. And he's piecing back together what must have happened and how the little shining man had this relationship with Mr. Yusa, and the little shining man exploded into a beautiful, brilliant, starry sky. And he's trying to figure out what that was all about. It's about 100 pages. It's one of the most beautiful and important books I've ever read. And Russell Hoban died at 86 this year. I highly recommend reading any and all of his children's books. I also remember he had a bunch of short stories he wrote. One that really stuck with me was a guy who goes to Spain and is trying to escape this monster that he's always imagined was going to follow him. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger the more he avoids it. And eventually he turns to face it and he realizes that it's actually shorter and smaller and weaker than him. And I always just thought that was a good parable. May all of these beautiful souls rest in peace. This reminds me of the time when Princess Di, Mother Teresa, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, and Jeff Buckley all died within like a week of each other. It's as if there's, at the end of decades, there's like this big old scythe that swings around and it just kind of takes a bunch of the angels away, like the really good ones. It's almost as if it's saying, wow, these ones were successful experiments. Let's take them back to the mill and use them for something else now, you know? I get that feeling. I really honestly do.
That would explain why the three of us are still sitting here.
Yeah.
Incidentally.
It's not our time yet.
The bunch of degenerates that we are.
Soon.
Well, let's see. Final things. Sunset 5, Lemley's Closed, which was the most beloved independent film theater in Hollywood.
Super
horrible.
Sad.
The Red Box is something we actually started using, which was the
shocking.
Even worse news. The Canon cameras came out with even better, faster 4K cameras this year, which is to say that the DSLR cameras that we thought might be just a passing trend are now more important than ever in Hollywood filmmaking. There's a movie called Like Crazy that was shot on a 7D or something, or on a Canon 5D that won Sundance.
Honestly, a lot of things are being shot on those, even music videos, everything. So,
do you guys have any final thoughts as we round out this hour for 2011, 2012 for our listeners?
Jeez.
You know, I'd say just the podcast that you guys have been gracious enough to have me along for this year, of which there have been a few, it seemed like we got very into kind of what was happening, the big picture, the global picture, things that were happening around the world, protests and uprisings and disasters and so forth. But really, 2011... a great year to spend close with your best friends, your family, the people you care about the most. And if you didn't do enough of that in 2011, do it in 2012.
Good one.
If you have to travel, if you have to get on a plane, if you have to drive, you just got to do it, because one thing is for certain, whether things go bad or don't go bad, we're only here for a very, very short amount of time.
Yep.
And those people, you can't take them with you and they can't take you with them. So reach out, touch someone, hopefully for real, touch someone, and enjoy your time on this planet. Enjoy that air you're breathing, and stay interesting, and let life happen to you.
Amen.
Thanks for listening.
Watch
you can find us online. Oh, yeah. Amy's going to be on The Closer next week, so make sure by the time you listen to this, you might have been gone by, but she may have been nominated for an Emmy. Who knows?
Who knows? Monday December 19th.
You can follow Amy on Twitter at Amy L. Chadwick. And you can follow the Karamcast at Karamcast. You can follow me at K. Maliki Sanchez. K-M-A-L-I-C-K-I Sanchez. Truffle Jones, still out in the woods. See if you can find the path.